and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, Dr. Pablo Blesa from Catholic University in Murcia, Spain. He was recorded speaking at the University of Alaska Anchorage bookstore on September 22nd. Listen to his talk on the Arab Spring and social media, new tools for democracy and government oppression, a look at the Middle East in 2011. Next on KSKA's Addressing Alaskans, after the news.
Thank you for coming to our event about the Arab Spring with Dr. Blesa. I'm Rachel Epstein, the events coordinator. Right now, I'd like to welcome Leslie Tuvenin, who works in the Office of International Affairs. There are many international departments at UAA, who has helped welcome Dr. Blesa here to UAA. And if you have any questions, please keep them in mind, and we'll have time for a question period after the presentation. So again, thank you for coming. And this is Leslie, who will welcome Dr. Blesa.
So again, my name is Leslie Tuvenin. I'm the International Affairs Coordinator at UAA. And since our director retired a few weeks ago, I am the Office of International Affairs. I'd like to welcome you today and also to welcome Dr. Blesa. Bienvenidos a todos. First, before I start with the introduction, I'd like to point out how special our bookstore is. You know, at many universities, a bookstore is a place where you buy books, maybe computers, a few snacks, your required athletic wear. But at UAA, it's also a meeting point for people with inquisitive minds who are curious about topics of the day and who want to come together for discussion and to learn more. And we've had some very, very high-powered, famous people at the bookstore, along with some people who are just plain interesting. So thank you to the bookstore. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce to you today Dr. Pablo Blesa Aledo, who comes to us from Murcia, Spain. His list of accomplishments is quite lengthy, and yes, I really do need this piece of paper for the introduction. Also, many of you are familiar with the many hats that your faculty and staff wear here at UAA. When you hear how many hats he wears, you're going to be exhausted. So Dr. Blesa is a professor in international relations and communications. He is also the vice rector of international relations at the Catholic University San Antonio de Murcia, and has been so since 2006. On top of that, he is the vice rector of international relations and communications since 2009, and we're not done yet, dean of the Faculty of Social Sciences and Communications since 2010. He also teaches international relations there. Professor Blesa is also the director of the master's program in European studies. In terms of his academic credentials, he has a European PhD from the Universidad Católica San Antonio de Murcia. He has several master's degrees, including degrees in international relations and communication sciences, international relations, and international relations and cooperation. Numerous professional titles and noteworthy titles. He has studied abroad himself in France and Canada, I believe, and also served as a visiting professor in an enviable number of countries. Now, since he's from the European Union, I guess he doesn't get stamps in his passports like you would, but you might want to think about adding these to your collection because you would get those stamps. We have Poland, Belgium, the U.S., Germany, Portugal, the United Kingdom, France, etc. Before joining the university, Dr. Blesa also worked in the Department of Political Communications for the Spanish political party called Partido Popular, and he was a journalist for the National News Agency as well as the director of an NGO. He's the author of several books. I'm going to limit the list that I read to you to those that are have English titles for your sake, Narrowing the Gap Between East and West, published in 2003, and Siamese Twins, The United States of Europe and the United States of America in the 21st Century. He's also the author of hundreds of newspaper articles and more than 30 scientific articles in, again, enviable, aspire to this please, 5 different languages. Dr. Blesa has visited 80 countries and 5 continents and speaks Spanish, English, French, and Italian. I am green with envy. Please give a warm welcome to Dr. Blesa.
Many thanks to all of you, my dear students, for being here. Thanks to Rachel and to Leslie. Leslie, for your presentation and the great work you are doing here to internationalize the university. Me and my wife, we're extremely happy to be here in Alaska. The other day, when I was talking in Fairbanks in the Chamber of Commerce, someone told me that many people in Alaska, many people that I met, including, for example, Rachel, they were not born in Alaska. And they told me this saying that I have made it part of my experience in Alaska. Once you have been in Alaska, you can never go home again. I believe and I wish this would be my case and the case of Regina, my wife, because in the 4 days we have been first in Fairbanks, now here, we have really experienced many of the best qualities that we always see in American people. Hospitality, intelligence, openness, and a very warm reception everywhere we have been. So many thanks for being here in this morning. You know, every time, and Leslie has listed a number of universities I have visited, as director and then vice rector of international relations, I have had the opportunity of visiting hundreds of universities. And always I remember the saying of one Spanish king called Alfonso X in the 10th century. This medieval king was the one that established the Spanish university system in its foundation. And he described at that time, 10 centuries ago, well, 11 centuries ago, the university as a gathering place where master and student join to look for knowledge and to have together an experience of sharing knowledge. And this is exactly what I would like to do here. I am a person from Spain. I have a Spanish citizen. I am a person from Europe. We are European. We have as well the European citizenship through the European Union. I feel a Westerner myself because I'm part of the Western world with the Americans. Americans and Europeans made the Western world. But I feel I'm as well a man from the Mediterranean Sea. This is my house. This is the Mediterranean Sea. As you can observe, the Mediterranean Sea looks from this perspective like a lake. This is Spain. On the other side, across the Gibraltar Strait, is North Africa. And this basin, this geopolitical space, is today a border, it's a wall, and it's a fracture. You know that in the world there are 3 great borders or walls that where inequality is extreme. The first one is the border between North Korea and South Korea. The second one is the border between the United States and Mexico. And the third one is this border between the South Mediterranean states, like Spain, France, Italy, Greece, and some others, Croatia, and the Arab world. Basically, the Arab world, which is divided, 320 million people, 320 million of Arabs, divided in 22 countries. The gap between the North and the South has been growing lately and became in steroids, as you can imagine, after September 11. And as you know, in 2004, Spain was attacked as well by Al-Qaeda, and 200 people were killed in trains. This is the most brutal attack in the European soil that ever happened in our history. If you compare with September 11, look small, 200 people, but for us, it's something absolutely brutal. This border has been growing, and this is a pity because not always the Mediterranean Sea has been a wall. As you know, during the Roman Empire, the Mediterranean Sea was a lake. The Romans were in the north and in the south. The Roman legislation ran this geopolitical space. And when the Roman Empire finally fell, the Mediterranean Sea did not become immediately a wall. It became a crossroad of cultures and people. Today, it's a wall. In the north, you have the rich people, rich countries. In the south, very poor countries. In the north, we have all consolidated democracies. In the south, consolidated tyrannies. In the north, we are Christian. In the south, they are Muslim. This normal. This, as you imagine, this description I have made only invite to antagonism and to hostility. And I first realized to what extent the stereotypes, the clichés, and the hostility was big one day in 2004 when I had the chance of having dinner with two intellectuals. The first intellectual was two women and very reputed intellectuals. The first one was Fatima Mernissi, a Moroccan intellectual. This, what is specific in Fatima Mernissi? Well, she's a woman from Morocco that had made her career in the United States and in France. And she is considered in the Western world a woman, very courageous woman, because she advocates human rights, democracy, and equal rights for women. On the other side of the table with me that night in 2004, there was an Italian woman. This woman has spent most of her life as a reporter in the Arab world. And then, which are the opinions of these Italian women about the South and the opinion of these Arab women about the North? Let me show you. In Fatima Mernissi, the Moroccan intellectual, wrote this book called Islam and Democracy. I will read only some fragments. But basically, this woman, who is considered a very pro-Western intellectual, writes in this book, "The Western world is militaristic and imperialistic," said Fatima, "and has traumatized other nations through colonial terror. Going down, the Western world is a power that crushes us, that asphyxiates our markets, and that controls our resources." If we look at the opinion of Oriana Fallaci, the Italian journalist, about the place where she worked for 23 years, the opinion could not be worse. This article, Rage and Pride, was written right after September 11 because she was living close to the World Trade Center. And then she wrote this terrible article saying that we were in a jihad, in a, you know, holy war between the Arab world and the Christian world. And that if we will not take care, eventually, we all will become Muslim and will be oppressed, and the Sharia will be the rule, the ruling norm, and the women will be obliged to wear the chador, and in other words, that Europe will be under a so-style Islamic Republic. In this context of both opinions, for me, made real the famous book, some of the theses of the famous book of the American scientist, he died recently, Samuel Huntington, in the book The Clash of Civilization, where he wrote that the 20th century conflict between liberal democracy and Marxist-Leninism is just a superficial historical phenomenon if compared with the 1,000-year-long conflict and war between Islam and Christianity. In this context that I have reflected, I have described, of hostility, suddenly, since December 2010, we have a cascade of democratic movements that has changed completely the face of the Arab world in 5 months. Probably you know the facts, probably you know the means of these revolutions in the Arab world, and I'm here to explain a little bit the causes. As for the facts, you know that in December 2010, some minor incident happens in Tunisia. There was a student called Mohamed Bouazizi. This student graduated from Tunis University with a degree in computing science. But this man with a degree in computing science were selling vegetables and potatoes in a small post in one of the squares of Tunis. This person was periodically harassed by the police. So one day, this Mohamed Bouazizi got crazy, put gasoline on himself, and killed himself. This is the beginning of the Arab Revolution. This provoked a revolution in Tunisia that at the end has changed the face of the Arab world. We have first the revolution in Tunisia, and Ben Ali was the president, was ousted, and the regime was overthrown. Immediately, the revolution moved to Egypt, the most important country in the Arab world with 70 million people, and with great influence in international in the region. And what happened there? We had the regime of Hosni Mubarak. Hosni Mubarak was an elected dictator. There were elections in Egypt. There were elections in Tunis as well. But they were false elections. They were all fraud elections. Hosni Mubarak usually won the election by 95% of the votes. Hosni Mubarak is said to have 50,000 million euros in bank accounts in the Cayman Islands and in Sweden. and in Switzerland as well. So after 10 days of revolution in the Tahrir, meaning the Freedom Square, the regime of Egypt failed. Then a civil war started in Libya. And as you know, the result of this civil war has been that with the support of NATO, meaning the Americans, the French, the British, the Spanish, and the Italian, Muammar al-Gaddafi, the man that bombed a Pan Am air flight, a Pan Am plane, in 1988, killing 300 Americans, has been expelled, and he's in exile right now with his family. We had as well a revolution in Syria, Hussein is not yet written. And we have constitutional changes almost in every country in the Arab world, from Morocco to Jordan. These are the facts. How the revolution has happened. Some of you, for example, Jaded, is a student of communication. Well, American technologies, especially, as you know, Facebook, Twitter, has been essential to understand how, for the first time, the people of the Arab world has been able to promote rallies, to make gatherings of thousands of people, and finally to overthrow the regimes. So the logistic, the technologies that somehow has made possible the revolution are Western technologies, American technologies. Usually these people have gathered on Fridays after noon, after the prayer, in what they call day of rage, and had stopped the countries completely. In Egypt, the country was stopped and shut down for 1 month. As you can imagine, no country can be shut down for 1 month without, at the end, provoke the ousting of the regime. So these are the facts, these are the means, and now I would like to explain you the causes. Why the Arab people are so enraged? Why they have, after the assassination, we could call it that way, the suicide of Mohamed Ouassissi, why it has sparked such a big revolution that has changed the face of the Arab world forever. Something close to the French Revolution. I would like to deal a little bit with the causes. Five features, in my view, could serve to describe how the Arab world has been in the last 30 years. In the first place, surprising, because these countries are very poor, a great accumulation of military power, economical and social underdevelopment, an incredible demographical growth, cultural decline, that explains as well the Al-Qaeda phenomenon, and regional nationalism, together with terrorism and with revolution. Let me touch some of these items briefly. In the first place, accumulation of military power. Some people believe, and this is in the Bible, that the Arab people naturally inclined to violence. For example, from 1925 to 1975, the Arabs were involved in 146 disputes. In 76 occasions, they recurred to war to solve the dispute. I strongly disagree with the classification that the Arabs are more warlike people than others, because I think that the more warlike people are the Europeans. The two most important world wars happened in Europe, and all the theory about war and all the technologies of war were invented in Europe, including the nuclear weapon that, through the Manhattan Project, was born in America, but with European scientists. Most of them were European scientists. But there are other alarming data. For example, following the United States Congressional Research Service, two-thirds of all the weapons that were sold in the war went to the Arab countries. Following the United States Air Control and Disarmament Agency, the Arabs bought 38% of all the weapons that were sold in the war. I'm talking about the years from 2000 to 2009. The Arab countries has a disproportionate defense budget. For example, the defense budget of Spain is 1.5 of GDP, gross domestic product. Any Mediterranean country of the European Union spends over 2% of the GDP in its defense. On the other hand, in the Arab world, there is no country that spends below 4%. Probably you could reach the conclusion that the Arab countries are simply protecting themselves from the United States and from Europe, from any potential invasion. But usually it's not the case. They are protecting themselves from the other Arabs, because the Arab states had a very confrontational relationship between themselves. As for the number of soldiers, in the European Union, the number of soldiers has been reduced 15% in the last 5 years. In the Arab world, the number of soldiers has increased 95% in the same period. As you see, a tremendous build-up in order probably to defend themselves from the Europeans, but to defend themselves from the other Arab countries as well. This huge investment in defense goes in contrast with the economical development or underdevelopment of these countries. I do not know what is the Human Development Index. You know that usually, in order to know the wealth of one country, we use the per capita income. So American per capita income is $30,000. Spanish per capita income is 28,000 euros, something like this. But of course, in this classification per capita, you don't really know how the wealth is distributed. There are some countries in which the most of the wealth is possessed by 1 or 2% of the population. So this data is not always good. Another way of assessing if a country is rich is simply by looking to the gross domestic product of that country, or the value of all the products and services that country produces. But again, we do not see to what extent the wealth is distributed. So what is the Human Development Index? It's a mathematical formula that takes account elements like, for example, how many doctors, schools, hospitals, universities, prices, how many people has access to healthcare and to education. So it basically tells us the quality of life in a particular country. Well, in this Human Development Index done by the United Nations, the European Mediterranean countries, Spain, Greece, Italy, Portugal, and France, always score very high, always among the 15 best in the planet. Meanwhile, the Arab countries always score below the 100th position, in a list of 160 positions. Some of these countries, like Saudi Arabia, occupy positions like 112, Morocco 85. If you go a little bit down, Sudan is 155 in a scale of 160. So you can see the tension that it creates. You have 14 kilometers from Spain, 340 million people that lives, many of them, 1 out of 5, live with $1 per day. So it's dire poverty. In the global economy, has grown 1.5%, I mean, taking the world as a whole, since 1975 to last year. Meanwhile, in the Arab world, only has grown 0.5%. So what happened? The Arab world is lagging behind economically, as you can see. Not only that, although the economies of the Arab world grow, the number of people increase so fast, the demographical growth is so fast, that there is no way to offer opportunities and jobs to all the people that enter the market every year. Every year, 3% of the population that were 17 years old entered the market. Although the economy is growing, there is no way you can offer jobs to all these people. It means that the rate of unemployment in the Arab world is from 20 to 30%. It means that more than 30 million people do not have jobs. Some of them are very well prepared and very well trained, like Mohamed Bouazizi, that has a degree in computing science. But why he was selling vegetables? The productivity, you know that the productivity rate is how many shoes an American worker produces in 1 hour in comparison with a Spanish or an Arab. This is the productivity rate. The productivity rate in the Arab world in the 60s compared with the American one was 32%. In the 70s was 20%. In the 90s was 50% and now was 10%. So the gap has been increasing. For the productivity. The industrial production of the European Mediterranean countries is 10 times bigger, 10 times superior than the South counterparts. If you look at the import and exports, Arab countries export 50% of all their products to the European Union, but these 350 million people only import 4% of all the European production. This data is interesting. Spain is a country of only 43 million people. The GDP of Spain, the gross domestic product of Spain, was equal to the gross domestic product of the 22 Arab nations in 2005. And although the dire poverty has been reduced slightly lately, still 1 out of 5 Arabs live with $1. How are the Arab economies? I don't know if any of you in this room is an economist. But basically, the Arab economies are completely dependent on raw material, particularly the export of oil and the export of gas to Europe. And something that surprised me is the small dimension of companies. For example, let us take a country like Egypt. There is a famous Egyptian scientist that ran a mega research about the companies in Egypt. Well, 98% of the companies in Egypt employ maximum 2 workers. Only 0.1% of all the companies in Egypt employ more than 100 workers. What happens if you have such small companies? That you simply repeat what you have learned from your father. You do not employ any money in research or development. You're always doing the same process for the same product, always. Then there is a tremendous lack of competitiveness. Here in the Arab world, the economy, this very asphyxiated economy is controlled by the state and some routine monopolies. And finally, there is a lot of corruption. This is the most corrupt area in the whole planet, following a famous agency called Transparency International. So these are the main features. But the question is, how the Arab states could advance in the globalized world? How the Arab countries could do better? And the reason could be, and the answer could be the following. You cannot develop if you are not free. If you do not free the people, for the people to be inventive, you cannot develop. You cannot develop if 50% of your population has not the right to be educated or the right to be occupied prominent leadership position. I'm talking about the women. And you cannot develop if you do not connect with a knowledge society, if you do not have a knowledge society. As for the challenge of freedom, following the index of freedom of the United Nations, the Arab world was the less free of the whole planet. There weren't any place in the planet where the people were so much slave by the government and by the system like in the Arab world. In fact, following the data that provides Freedom House, the Freedom House Agency, 5 of the world's 10 tyrannies and dictatorships in the world were in the Arab world. And finally, this is something that surprised me in the last five years. We have a research group in the university that were running some polls. And we asked the Arabs this question. Democracy is the best system of government. We asked this question in 2008. In 2009. And the answer was that the Arabs were the people that wanted in the whole planet to reach the level of freedom. 85% of the Arabs responded yes, and a total yes, to the assertion democracy is the best system of government. This explained this revolution. The Arabs, most of them, not the fanatics that join Al-Qaeda in a very limited number, really. The people really wanted freedom. They wanted to have the possibility of giving their children more opportunities. But those governments that were supported by the European countries, one had to confess that the European countries were supporting the tyrannies, this government suffocated the level of freedom of their population.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Dr. Pablo Blesa, professor at Catholic University in Murcia, Spain. He was recorded at the UAA bookstore on September 22nd, speaking on the Arab Spring and social media, new tools for democracy and government oppression, a look at the Middle East in 2011.
The challenge of women empowerment. I think you know quite well, and I will give you some data, that even in the Western world, it's difficult to find many women at the top of important businesses or at the top of the political elite. For example, in Spain, only 10% of the executive jobs are occupied by women. But in the Arab world, it was something outrageous, because women do not have the right, for example, to drive a taxi. They do not have the right in many countries to go to the university. They do not have the right to occupy, to participate in politics, and sometimes they do not have the right even to vote. It's true that some small steps has been taken lately, and the women progressively are acquiring a bit more responsibility, but in a very limited scope. The challenge of knowledge society. A society, I will deal with this issue a bit later, but simply to state here now that a society that does not use internet, that does not have access to mobile phones, that does not have access to Facebook, this society is separated from the world economy and from the globalization phenomenon. And then you are condemned to be a kind of reserve in this planet. There are another two challenges I would like to touch briefly that the Arab world face. In the first place is desertification, because 15 out of the 22 Arab states are below the water poverty line. You know that without water, it's very difficult to develop economically. If you don't have a beautiful river close by, and you don't have access to potable water, you cannot develop. And another challenge is pollution, because pollution costs to the Arab world $2 billion per year, in terms of losing tourism, losing resources, etc. The demographical role of these countries, we have seen that these countries invest heavily in weapons. We have seen that they are poor and doing very bad economically. And now it's very important to understand the synergies in the Arab world to see the demographical growth. I will simply touch two or three data. In the first place, the countries of the South of Europe were 50%, the South of Europe meaning the European countries, were 50% of the total population of the Mediterranean basin in 1980. In 2020, there will be only 30% of the population. The South, the Arab birth rate is 10 times superior than in Spain, but the income is 30 times inferior. And if you go to the last item here, the fertility rate in the South is every Arab woman has 6 children average, and in Spain, every Spanish woman has 0.5 children average. What happened in this context? That our societies are aging in Europe. Some of them are even diminishing, the population is diminishing. Meanwhile, in the south, in the north of Africa, or in the south of the Mediterranean, as you wanted, the population is growing tremendously. So that in 20 years, the population could jump from 300 million Arabs to 600. What happened in a geopolitical space where just crossing the border, which is 14 kilometers, you can access good education, freedom, and opportunities for you. Meanwhile, in the south, you have unemployment, you have a lot of people competing for the jobs, and you have no opportunities. As you can imagine, the result is a tremendous immigration pressure. And what happened? We cannot assess how many people have died in the last 15 years trying to cross the Mediterranean basin, sea, in small boats. We cannot really assess. Could be in the thousands. For sure. But not only is the fact that they want to escape from their countries, is the fact that in order for us to be able to run our businesses, to be able to pay the pensions to all people, we will need 6,000 youngsters from the Arab world every day for the next 30 years. So, on the one hand, is that they want to escape, in the other hand, is that we need young people, young blood, to work in our businesses. But what happened in a moment of crisis like now? You surely remember that in Norway, which is not part of the European Union, 1 month ago, in August, one crazy guy took a rifle and killed 85 young Norwegians. No Arabs, Norwegians. Fellow Norwegians. This guy, his political motivation was this. Here in Norway, we are accepting too many foreigners, especially Arabs, And eventually, in 40 or 50 years, the European Union will be an Islamic republic. This is the thinking of these people. He was crazy. But there are many, like mushrooms, more and more political parties in the European Union, especially France, like Le Pen, in Denmark, in Finland, especially the blonde people, the people from the Scandinavian countries, that they are very scared of their genetics to change, for the mixing, and as well of seeing mosques in the skyline. Especially, we have an incident very recently in Switzerland where the parliament finally approved a law by which the mosques in Switzerland could not have a minaret, could not have a tower, because they asserted that the tower is a symbol of power by the Arabs. It's a symbol of conquest. So they do not allow them to have a tower. The cultural frontier, I will give you some data. Well, not only that the number of computers and the number of telephones and the number of newspapers is very small in the Arab world. Let us go, we're in a bookstore. It's a fantastic place, this cathedral of knowledge that is a bookstore. In the Arab world, a year, 300 million people, they print, they publish 6,000 books. To give you a comparison, in South America, more or less the same number of people, they publish 85,000 books. And in the United States, every year, almost 200,000 books. In the Arab world, a book that sells more than 3,000 copies is a bestseller. And among the bestseller, 20% of the books that sold more than 3,000 copies, 20% are religious books. Another data always surprised me. In Spain, in any given year, we publish more books than the whole Arab world since 1945 to 2005. So that you can see, the level of literacy is very low. And if you go to other data, for example, research publication. The Arabs publish 26 research articles per every million people. In Switzerland, they publish 2,000 articles per every million people. And for example, in the Netherlands, they publish 1,500 articles per every million people. You can compare. Another striking factor in the Arab world is that there is no audiovisual industry. There are no cinemas. The only country that has some audiovisual industry is Egypt. And Egypt, a population of 70 million people, has 200 cinema theaters in the whole country. There are 65 million of illiterate people and 10 million children that are not schooled. Not to mention the investment in research and development, which is 1/7 of the world average. But there is one striking data I would like two elements more. Well, look at the Spanish university system. In Spain, the typical university has 200 years. In the Arab world, the typical university has 15 years. They're very young institutions. There are very few, and they are very, very young. And brain drain. 25% of all the doctors emigrate every year. 23% of all the graduated students emigrate. So there is a tremendous brain drain in these countries. Let us take all these elements I have introduced to you all together. High spending in weapons. Social and economic underdevelopment. No knowledge society, no opportunities. What do you have? What you have is 300 people that are extremely frustrated. What happens when you are frustrated? Well, sometimes what can happen if you are frustrated is that you look at the Quran and said, well, we are lacking so behind, we are doing so bad because we are not following the religious test, because we are not sufficiently pure. And this is the result of this is Al-Qaeda. The other reading is we are lacking behind because we are not connected. We should connect and we should assimilate what can be assimilated from those who are doing so well, the Europeans, the Americans, the Chinese. So facing frustration, you have three responses. Those countries of the Arab world or the Muslim world that they have opted for the Western ticket. So it means political and cultural westernization. Now, in this moment of changes in the Arab world, countries in the Arab world are looking to two examples. The one example that very well represents the first option is Turkey. So in Egypt, in Tunisia, eventually in Libya, they will say, we want to be Iran. We want to be an Islamic republic like Iran. This morning, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, is in the United Nations, surely making tremendous comments. Every year, this guy, the president of Iran, makes some striking comments. So be alert and pay attention to what Ahmadinejad is going to say, because you know that the Iranians are now has the capability to enrich uranium. And eventually, this uranium could be used for producing electricity or for producing a nuclear weapon. And that would be extremely dangerous, as you can imagine. So the Western ticket would be to do what Turkey did. You know that Turkey is a country that wants to be part of the European Union since 1968, that is part of NATO, that is totally westernized, that is like, the government is like, and it's a country that opted for democracy from 1923 because from inside, not because they were invaded or democracy was imposed. They wanted to be a democracy. Atatürk, the father of Turkey, transformed Turkey into a democracy and connected Turkey with the Western world through the United States in NATO and eventually through the European Union to the European Union and to Europe. The other ticket is the moderate ticket. People that say, well, we certainly must be friends of the Europeans and the Americans, and we must assimilate and take into our country some of the elements in their economies that are making these countries to do well. But at the same time, we must keep our culture, our religion, and our way of government intact. One case in point is Morocco. You know that Morocco is a monarchy where the monarch is the religious leader, is the political leader and head of the country, is the head of the security forces and the army. And at the same time, the monarchy possessed 40% of all the businesses and land in Morocco. But they are very, very friendly with the Europeans and the Americans. So let us assimilate what is good, but our regime, our way of government should not change. And the final ticket is the radical ticket. And the radical ticket has two expressions. One is fundamentalism and Al-Qaeda. In this case, Al-Qaeda in Maghreb. And the other ticket is what we have seen. The big majority of people, the big majority of the Arabs are not stupid. And they want their children to have opportunities, to have education, to be happy, and if possible, that they can stay in their countries without the need to emigrate. So this is the situation, this is the picture of the Arab world, very briefly. And now, with great pleasure, I will take your questions. And thank you very much for your patience. It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Dr. Pablo Blesa, professor at Catholic University in Murcia, Spain. He was recorded at the UAA bookstore on September 22nd, speaking on the Arab Spring and social media, new tools for democracy and government oppression, a look at the Middle East in 2011. Following his talk, Dr. Blesa responded to audience member questions. First, he was asked, how do you explain the disconnect between French policy in Libya and French laws banning headscarves or burqas?
Yes, but don't look at this Don't look at this strictly in a Arab versus Christian antagonism or hostility. For example, I give you an example so that you can understand what I'm saying. In the first place, the French in their laws do not only forbid Arab religious symbols to be present in their schools and in public places, as well Christian symbols. And I will give you an example. In 2004, the European Union was about to approve a constitution, not a treaty, but a constitution for the European Union. It was a very special constitution, but I will not enter into the legal nature of this constitution. It was a mixed treaty, mixed constitution. But it's called the Constitution of the European Union. In the front of this constitution, there was a huge debate if God should be mentioned and Christianity should be mentioned. Christianity as a root, cultural root of Europe, no? So Europe, the European culture, could be the result of three rivers, cultural rivers, the Greek, the Romans, and Christianity. Well, most French people, and it is well known that for the Holy See, France has always been the princess. It is said that France the princess, Spain the second princess, something like that. But France has been always a very Catholic, Christian state. And still today, France is mostly a Christian country, and Catholic. But the country opposing that any reference to Christianity or to God be present at the beginning, in the protocol, at the entrance of the European Constitution was France. So France as a like state, this is the second element of France. France has the Christianity and has the French Revolution. And from the French Revolution, you have agnosticism and atheism. And Masonic thinking too. So what happened? The French Republic is very, extremely like. So they don't want to see religious symbols, including crosses, in schools, in public places. For example, in Spain today, when you are nominated minister or any position of leadership, still today in Spain, you make the oath on a Bible. It has nothing to do with the religious feeling in the United States. Because we Regina and me, we were very surprised. We knew, but we were surprised on the level of religiosity in Alaska and in the United States. For example, something that could be totally unthinkable and like coming from a dream in Europe is that in the Chamber of Commerce of Fairbanks, at the very beginning of my speech there, a reverend made everyone to stand up, and there was a prayer, and there was as well everyone singing the anthem or the hymn of the United States. This in Europe could be, but most of the people, even in a no atheist context, people will not understand. So the European societies are today extremely relativistic. The religious feeling is very low. Churches are getting empty. And in public life, it's not politically correct to mention God, to pray, nothing of the sort. It looks like you are a crazy man. Like a crazy man. So in the case of France, the French Republic is extremely like, and is not allowed any symbol, neither Muslim, Jew, or Christian, inside the public places, the schools, the universities, or the president office, or any other office. What happened? That the Muslim, in the case of the Muslim, and I understand the Muslims, there is a school girl that she wants to go to the school with handkerchief in her head. I don't think this is a crime. I don't think you have to prosecute neither this nor one wearing a cross. I don't let people be free. Another different thing I understand is that you are with a burqa. I mean, if you have to go to for security reasons, your body is totally covered. I think the burqa, not the handkerchief, but the burqa, is really a symbol of domination of the men over the women. But the handkerchief, a cross, David Starr, I don't think you are really aggressing anyone around you. So it's not that the French Republic is against the Islamic people, Muslim people, or Arab people. No, it's simply that they are against any symbol.
Next, another audience member asked Dr. Blesa, would the Egyptian Revolution have been possible if Egyptians did not have access to social media?
It's a very important question, because in the first place, I was giving some data as for the low limited access that Arab people has had traditionally to internet, to telephones, to newspaper. I was talking about a society with 65 millions of illiterate people out of 320 million. But I have to complete my what I have said during my speech by saying that in the last 10, 15 years, the Arab dictatorships, in order to comply with the so-called goals of the millennium set by the United Nations and to give a more polite image to the external world, open up the universities, open up the use of computers and internet and social media, and there was, and this plain, this revolution. In this revolution, the leaders of this revolution were young people that have studied in the university, that in many cases had studied outside their own countries, had studied in Europe or in the United States, that knew that there was, and through the television, everyone know that there is another world very close to your border where people have more freedom, more opportunities, etc. And social networks and Twitter and internet has facilitated two things. First, the access to know that this wall is accessible and is not only the television. So now the Western world enter in your life not only through the television, but through the internet and through the Facebook and through the other connections. So the Arab Spring would have been impossible without more educated people that were able to connect with people living on the other side, on the United States and in other places. This is in the first place, more educated people. Using with total normality social networks. But in the second place, the gatherings, the strikes in countries where the state control the mass media, meaning the radio, the television and the press, would have been impossible without the evolution in the last 10 years that allow more people to have access to mobile phones, to use MSS, and then to connect, because there are more computers, to connect through social networks, and therefore to be able to call for a gathering, thousands of people from one day to the other. So, as you know, at the beginning of the clashes, especially in Egypt, at the very beginning, and the war between the system, the formal system, the state, Hosni Mubarak, the security forces, and the people, were not clashes on the streets fighting each other. That happened later on. At the beginning was a war of intelligence. The system, the state, the government, tried to shut down internet. They tried to shut down the social networks, but they couldn't. They couldn't. And then when the state lost the fight, the communication fight, the international media, meaning the CNN, all the European newspaper, came to the Tahrir Square to broadcast in the world the revolution, then the state became brutal and sent, as you remember probably, in the middle of the revolution in Egypt, the state sent mercenaries disguised as supporters to the Tahrir Square. And there were only two or three occasions where the insurgents, well, the people and the mercenaries clashed. And there were some casualties. But only when the state realized that they couldn't control the social media and they had lost the battle of communication. And you know that when you lose the battle of communication, you have lost, at least in the globalized world that we live today. So without internet, without mobile telephones, without Facebook, Twitter, and social media, certainly the revolution has been impossible. Lately, at the beginning of the revolution, the war between the system and the state and the people was a war in internet to see who could win the communication battle. When they lost the communication battle, they tried to shut down the system, they couldn't. And then when they knew that they could not control the internet, then they sent mercenaries to fight the people on the streets, and there were some clashes. But because the system wanted, the government, Hosni Mubarak, wanted to see the resilience of the people. So after killing two or three people there and injuring several hundreds, the people stay. And then they receive immediately the American support through Obama, Hillary Clinton, and the European support. And then, of course, Hosni Mubarak knew he was dead. He was a political casualty. He was dead. And that was what happened. So thank you very much for your time and for your question. It was a great pleasure. Thank you. Thank you.
This is KESKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Dr. Pablo Blesa, professor at Catholic University in Murcia, Spain. He responded to audience questions following his talk on the Arab Spring and social media, new tools for democracy and government oppression, a look at the Middle East in 2011, which was recorded at the UAA bookstore on September 22nd, 2011. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our new website, alaskapublic.org. Let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.